From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Sunnyvale down by Great America.
Sunset District.
In between Cupertino and Saratoga.
Coming up, as the country focuses on jobs and the economy this election year, we get the latest from the Democratic National Convention in North Carolina.
Let's assume Obama wins. He's still going to probably have a Republican House of Representatives. And so without some sort of shift somewhere, we're going to be back in the logjam that we've been in for the last several years.
Then it's back to the Bay Area, where we'll forage for food in the East Bay.
Yeah, my dining room is my urban area, I guess.
After having a bite to eat, we go to get some clothes on a zero budget at the really, really free market.
It's okay to give. It's really okay to give, and it feels good.
You'll find a great deal in today's Cross Currents. Stay with us. The Democratic National Convention is underway in Charlotte, North Carolina, and current and former Bay Area political stars are taking the stage. Speaking at the convention are House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, Congresswomen Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein, Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, and California's Attorney General Kamala Harris. Here she is speaking at this morning's Delegates Breakfast.
So let's rededicate ourselves. Let's eat our breakfast. Let's get out there. This is the first day of this convention. And let's be loud. Let's be proud as Californians.
So what should we expect at this year's convention? On the ground in Charlotte is San Francisco Examiner reporter Melissa Griffin. We called her up earlier today, and I asked her what issues are on delegates' minds.
The sense that I've gotten is that they want details. They really are here to learn more about the policies of the Obama administration and what to expect in the next 4 years. I don't think that they're here to be convinced necessarily. I believe that they will all ultimately vote for Obama, but I think they all understand that they are going to be tasked with helping this effort. And in the course of that, they're going to need to be able to persuade their neighbors and friends. And they need some talking points, basically. They need to know how to answer that question, what is Obama going to do on day one if we reelect him to office? And they're looking for those answers here at this convention. I think they'd be highly disappointed if they didn't receive them.
And what are some of the issues that they're really looking for answers for?
For example, one delegate from Texas is telling me that he's Hispanic, and he's looking to help get out the Hispanic vote, but he's not entirely sure how to go about it. He needs a little more direction from the Obama administration in order to know how to persuade people to say that this is what my immigration policy is going to be. This is how I'm going to move forward and make things better for people who are here lawfully and people who wish to become citizens.
Right. I would imagine some of the California delegation would also have that same issue on their mind, the issue of immigration. Have they said anything about what they are there for or what issues they want to focus on?
Everybody understands, I think, that the economy is the issue and understanding how we can move forward. Because here's the thing. Let's assume Obama wins. He's still going to probably have a Republican House of Representatives. And so without some sort of shift somewhere, we're going to be back in the logjam that we've been in for the last several years. So people are looking for answers to that question as well. So let's just, you know, if we elect you and for some reason lose the House, how is anything going to change? And they're looking for answers to that.
And is there any word as to, like, do you, the media, get kind of a sneak peek into his speech and what he's going to focus on and what he's going to talk about and whether their questions will be answered?
We're being promised that we will get substantive policy statements and, again, put the meat on the bones of the overall party ethos. We're being told that we can expect that. Whether that's going to come from Obama or whether it's going to come from his other speakers that are lined up to address the audience is not clear. We very last minute keep getting these updates. Tonight's speech from Michelle Obama is not going to be a policy speech. We know that. That's going to be a humanizing type address. So we know that we're not going to expect it from her. And as far as Obama's speech goes, my understanding is it's still being written. So, again, overall, we're being promised it, but from whom we might receive it, I am not sure.
Who are some of the main people that we're looking out for? I know Kamala Harris is speaking. When is she speaking? Tomorrow?
She's speaking, I believe, yes, tomorrow.
She's speaking tomorrow. Very well-known in California and San Francisco. Who else should we be looking out for?
Well, Barbara Lee, who is the congresswoman from the East Bay, is also going to be speaking. Nancy Pelosi is going to be speaking. So in terms of the Bay Area, those are some people who will be here addressing the audience. In addition, of course, we have Jimmy Carter, who's going to come in via satellite. I think right now, though, the big one that people are really eager to see is Bill Clinton. He carries a lot of panache still within the party, and I also understand that he his speech is not going to be entirely vetted by the Obama folks before he gives it. So if there is going to be, and not a Clint Eastwood moment, but if there is going to be anything that's a little unscripted or it goes a little sideways, it will probably be in Bill Clinton's speech. As you know, in the past, he's occasionally gone off the rails a little bit at times. So whether he sticks to the script is going to be very interesting, and I think he's the one that people are really eager to hear from.
Last week, we talked about diversity at the Republican National Convention. What's it like here?
Very, very different. I mean, we haven't seen the panoply of delegates yet in the arena, but I can tell you just by looking around that it's a far more diverse group. We're being told by the DNC that 50% of the delegates are female, that some 600 delegates are Hispanic. So we've got some statistics, but I'm eager to see what the arena looks like tonight when everybody's packed in. I think it'll look somewhat different from the Republican convention.
That's San Francisco Examiner reporter Melissa Griffin. We spoke to her earlier at the Democratic National Convention. You can find links to all our election coverage on our website, kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. There's one issue that both parties are dealing with in this upcoming election, the economy. And that brings us to today's installment of Here, Here.
Here,
Here,
Here.
Okay, together. Okay.
Here, Here.
A pop-up radio project.
From KALW. In San Francisco, the unemployment rate surpassed 7.5% in July, just short of the national average. But across the bay, in Oakland, unemployment reached a startling 14.5%. Our Here Here community storytelling team recently met one Oakland resident who lost her job, but found a new way to feed herself.
I don't find food, I hunt for food. My name is Visalia Stanley, and I live in Oakland, California, in the Temescal area. I walked for about 3 hours this morning looking for food, and I found a couple of lemons, and I think they were kumquats, I'm not really sure, and a couple of plums. That was breakfast. You know, I wake up kind of early sometimes and do it. I try not to go too far off of the sidewalk, just if my arm can reach from the sidewalk, or if I see someone that has an abundant tree, like mandarins or oranges or something like that, I'll ask them, you know, hey, can I come take some off your tree? And if I come again, do I need to ask you? Or so I try and be really respectful of it. Like I've learned how to pick what I need, even the herbs I've learned just to find them. Rosemary, lemon, mugwort, different kinds of sage, chard, there's apples, lemon verbena. I know I can make tea from lemon verbena, and I can bathe in lemon verbena or do whatever I want to do with lemon verbena. It's like going to the grocery store. My dining room is my urban area, I guess. I don't really have a name for it because it's not really a big deal to me. It's just something that I'm doing while I'm looking for employment. So I just decided to start walking around and seeing what I could find. That's just the way that I chose to ground myself and survive. Maybe I'll live longer if I just walked around and found fruit and vegetables and things like this, and it actually works. I'm here, still alive. Hopefully that, you know, it never leaves my life. And so hopefully whatever job I get or whichever route I go next, I'm able to walk a lot and kind of keep myself centered and always looking up, you know. Always walk and look up.
That was Oakland resident Visalia Stanley. She spoke with KALW's Erica Mu at the Temescal Library in Oakland. We want you to share your story with us. Visit kalw.org and click on Here, Here to find out which library our community storytelling team will be popping up at next. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. If you're between jobs, you might be innovative with your food like Visalia Stanley. And when you're low on cash, there are a couple of ways to shop for clothes, shoes, or anything else you may need. You could probably find some good deals online at FreeCycle or on Craigslist. You can also hit the secondhand stores. And here in San Francisco, you can go to the monthly Really, Really Free Market.
It's always more fun to share with everyone.
No coercion, no compulsion, just purely for the spirit of generosity.
Hey, Bert, would you share that half a cookie with me?
Sharing is hard sometimes for everyone, isn't it?
Instead of saying, what can I get, what can I give?
The Really, Really Free Market is a swap meet, but without the price tags. As part of our series on the sharing economy, KALW's Stephen Short takes us there in this piece from our archives.
If you like to socialize and get stuff for free, then the Really, Really Free Market may be for you. It's the last Saturday of each month at Dolores Park in San Francisco's Mission District, starting at noon.
Is it really for free or do we have to buy it?
No, everything here is free.
Do we have to water? I mean, how? Does it need water every day?
Well, it depends on how much sun it gets.
Vichuard and Calopy Biswas are from South San Jose. They've stumbled upon a man giving away little starter plants.
This is the first time we are seeing something like this happen, so we were really curious about it.
And it's an interesting experience, so yeah, so far we've been enjoying it.
Well, I heard you ask the man in surprise if this was actually free, and so this is a surprise to you.
Yeah, this is the first time we have seen a really free market, so yeah, that was definitely a nice surprise.
From a distance, the Really, Really Free Market might be mistaken for an exotic picnic. Blankets have been laid out in the shade in an orderly manner so that it's easy to walk among them. There's no food on the blankets, although one group is giving away chocolate chip cookies. Still, it is a potluck of goods. There's a pair of dark blue shorts draped on a wheeled suitcase. A colorful display of women's shoes fills most of another blanket, while the one next to it has computer keyboards. A man is offering chair massage. And as with any potluck, the offerings change depending on the time you arrive.
The Really, Really Free Market actually was started in the 1600s.
Frank Lindsay wasn't around back then, but he has been a regular at this market since it started in 2005.
In the 60s, in the Haight-Ashbury district, a similar thing was done as well. And then that died off as the 60s waned into the 70s, and this was a revitalization.
That's appropriate, since it was San Francisco's namesake, St. Francis of Assisi, who said, "For it is in giving that we receive." Philip Hayden is visiting from Ireland and thinks such a market would be shocking to people there.
Yes. To see that people readily are picking up items that are free. They just feel that they are entitled to it, and they feel that there's nothing wrong with it, that it's just a good way to be.
Frank Lindsay says Hayden has latched onto the most unique thing he can take away from here.
Giving. That's the one thing that I think is one of the neatest little things that is taught here is that it's okay to give. It's really okay to give, and it feels good.
Lindsay was a family friend of Kirsten Bridham, the 25-year-old activist who started this free-for-all. In a sad irony, this woman who wanted people to give freely was robbed and murdered in September while on a bicycling trip. Her friends are continuing the Really, Really Free Market as a living memorial. Lauren Moody is another person who shares this spirit of giving. She brought some things to pass along, not expecting to find anything herself.
But it looks like you have found something here. You have something under your arm. What do you have there?
A pizza stone.
No. A pizza stone. And what did this cost you?
It was free. Maybe a smile. That's about it.
In Dolores Park in San Francisco, I'm Stephen Short for Cross Currents.
The San Francisco Really, Really Free Market meets on the last Saturday of the month in Dolores Park. Details are at KALW.org.
We'll be right back.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Often, the hard times don't come from the economy or a lost job or a cash shortage. Sometimes they come from a natural disaster.
Governor Jerry Brown has declared a state of emergency for areas dealing with wildfires this afternoon. Those wildfires are still burning in three Northern California counties.
With three California counties officially in a state of emergency and tens of thousands of acres affected, wildfire season is very much here. This isn't out of the ordinary. In fact, it's more like normal for California. Last year, just under 127,000 acres burned. The year before that, the number was 108,000. According to science commentator Max McClure, our chronic wildfire problem is just another side effect of humans knocking ecosystems out of whack. But this time, it's not what we're doing, it's what we're not.
Here in California, the wildfire is an emblem of catastrophic carelessness. A single cigarette butt dropped in moronic innocence can easily set off something like the fires we've seen this summer in Lake, Shasta, Tehama, San Diego, Mendocino and Riverside counties, Joshua Tree, Plumas National Forest, Yosemite, etc. Our hazy skies are nothing new. 400 years ago, the landscape here was similarly defined by fire. In 1602, the Spanish explorer Sebastian Vizcaino said there were so many columns of smoke on the California mainland that at night it looked like a procession, and in the daytime the sky was overcast. This was the case more or less across the entire state. But there's a key difference between then and now. What Vizcaino saw were contained fires, set deliberately by the people who lived in California at that time. By now, I think most people have worked out that regular, small-scale burns protect against the out-of-control variety by preventing fuel buildup. That's why the National Park Service uses them, at least when Smokey is on the lecture circuit. But it's not actually why native Californians set fires. Their burns were the cornerstone of what you could call an alternate approach to agriculture, very different from old-world farming. Burns increased the growth of edible seed-bearing grasses. They encouraged plants like sourberry and button willow to grow straight branches that could be used to make tools. They concentrated deer and rabbit populations into convenient pastures, making them easier to hunt. And they killed off parasites in food trees like the California fan palm and the tanbark oak. Over time, these burns had some unintended ecological effects. You don't work a region over for thousands of years without seeing some changes. But they weren't necessarily what you'd expect. The standard progression of human agriculture more or less goes like this. Man begins farming. Man inadvertently starts killing off every damn thing he isn't farming. Fire-based agriculture works differently, by creating the kind of mosaic landscape that actually benefits biodiversity. In certain cases, it may have even been necessary for it. Some researchers think that chaparral, everyone's favorite endemic coastal evergreen scrubland, seems dependent enough on small, controlled fires that it likely co-evolved with them. This annoyingly balanced bit of ecology was thrown out as soon as Europeans got a foothold in the region. Efforts to stamp out the Indians' madcap, frivolous arson started early. California's first ban on burning vegetation showed up in 1793 and was mainly intended to keep all those flames from impinging on the kind of orderly agriculture the Spanish preferred. But it was the subsequent disruptions of traditional life, forcible relocation into missions, devastating epidemics, land grabs, that ended up putting out these fires pretty much for good. The cost of this shift wasn't just the occasional massive conflagration. As the planned burns went, so went these highly productive native ecosystems. Less fire-adapted, often invasive species gained the upper hand, in some cases dramatically changing the California landscape. And now with more and more people living near wildlands, bringing them back is impractical and potentially deadly. Today's wildfires are symbols of carelessness. But truly thorough, comprehensive carelessness isn't just about doing stupid things you're not supposed to do. It's also about dereliction of duty. When we put our minds to it, humans have the capacity to be ecological team players, which I'm sure is a great comfort if you're watching the red glow rising over Lassen.
Max McClure is a science writer in Palo Alto.
So what kind of science-related issues would you like us to discuss? Suggest some topics at our Facebook page, KALW News, or tweet them at us at KALW News. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. And now for some artery, cultural coverage that can find humor in the nerdiest of places.
That's funny.
The Bay Area is home to some of the smartest people on the planet. So it makes sense that our brainy nature would demand the occasional brainy entertainment. That's where Brian Malo, the science comedian, comes in. Malo stopped by KALW to tell Roman Mars why he thinks science is so funny in this piece from our archives.
I saw a movie with my friend Chuck, and I don't like seeing movies with him because he always has to sit in the front row because he thinks he gets to see the movie before anybody else. And you can't argue with him because he always has the trump card. The speed of light is finite, Brian. And it's true, the speed of light is finite, but it's very fast. You know, anyone know the speed of light? 186,000 miles per second. So if you had a theater, and this is what I told Chuck, if you had a theater 186,000 miles long, you would only see the movie 1 second before the guy in the last row. And he said, yeah, but you'd hear it a week and a half before him. And you probably wouldn't get your popcorn for years. And yes, I did do the math for that joke. Thank you.
My name is Brian Malo, and I'm a science comedian. The science part is older than the comedy part. I've always been interested in science and science fiction from a pretty young age. So when I started doing stand-up, it was only natural for that to influence the language I would use and the sorts of topics that I might be drawn to.
Viruses are really interesting. I suspect most people here know a little bit about it, but just the basic idea that what a virus does, it goes into a cell and then just takes over the machinery and turns it to its own uses. It's just like a, you know, hostile takeover under new management. I mean, it's really weird. It's kind of like going into a Coke factory and having them crank out Pepsi. Or even weirder, like going into a Nike factory and having them make Twinkies.
I haven't always called myself a science comedian. I was just a stand-up comic like anyone else. Like anyone else. And, you know, like you, for instance.
A virus walks into a bar. The bartender says, we don't serve viruses. The virus replaces the bartender and says, now we do.
Most comics' dream is to make it in a nightclub and to make it in a theater, especially a seedy underground with stone walls. That's the dream, really. And corporate gigs have always been considered a sellout because you can't do anything provocative. Not only can you not use a lot of language, you got to just totally stay away from certain topics. What I discovered at some point, and it was a revelation, I realized that in a way, I was editing myself more in a nightclub than I was at some corporate events. And if there were enough engineers and sort of techie people, I could pull out some pretty geeky stuff and they would laugh. Whereas you say the same joke at a nightclub, then you might just get this silence. So with that audience, the same sensibilities that I have, I could speak pretty freely, and the things that I kind of want to say and the way I want to phrase it would work really well.
I noticed a long time ago, whenever my mom would lose weight, my dad would gain weight. And when my dad lost weight, my mom gained weight. It was like the conservation of mass within our family. I had a theory that you never actually lose weight. You just give it to somebody else. Fat can be neither created nor destroyed. It's one of the basic laws of the universe.
I like what I'm doing in that there are really two different sides to it. I can perform to specialized groups and really play to their special interests and special knowledge. And I can make these references that very few other people are going to get. But on the other hand, I like performing to general audiences. And in that case, it's a little different. I'm not going to bombard them with obscure references. I can amuse them without it going over anyone's head, really.
What I figure is some of the appeal of science comedy is that your audience, like, some of them feel like there's been no one who speaks just to them in a way that appeals to their particular sense of humor. So what I'm hoping for is for you to tell me your most technical, your most advanced joke so I can make one Cross Currents listener exceptionally happy right now.
One of my favorites is about
my relationships with women. Women have passed through my life like exotic particles through a cloud chamber, leaving only vapor trails for me to study for clues to their nature. If that doesn't even sound like a joke, maybe you should think of it as a poem. A little bit of poetry, really, and why can't it be both, in fact?
It's a scientific fact.
A scientific fact.
It has to be correct.
It has to be exact.
Because it is a scientific fact.
Brian Malo spoke with Roman Mars, host of the radio design show 99% Invisible here on KALW. Malo's latest CD is called Rational Comedy for an Irrational Planet. We'll show you how to get your hands on it at KALW.org. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Zoe Bresny, Julie Kane, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, RTM's Konahovs, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Moo, Mary Reese, Stephen Short, and Anna Sterling. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thank you, we're listener-supported radio. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.